My brave lad, he sleeps in his faded coat of blue. In a lonely grave alone lies the heart that beats so true. They will find him and know him amongst the good and true, when a robe of white is given for that faded coat of blue. No more the bugle.
Welcome to War of the Rebellion, Stories of the Civil War. I am your host, Leon Mauser, and this is a reading of the regimental history Under the Maltese Cross, Antietam to Appomattox, The Loyal Uprising in Western Pennsylvania, 1861 to 1865, Campaigns 155th Pennsylvania Regiment, narrated by the rank and file. This is Episode 24, Chapter 12, The Battles of Laurel Hill and Spotsylvania. Night march of Union Army to Spotsylvania Courthouse. Flank movements led by Sheridan's cavalry. Encounters enemy in force at Alsop's farm late in the morning. Severe engagement ensues. General Sedgwick killed by Confederate sharpshooter. Generals Warren and Griffin both active in directing troops to points of attack. Spirited attack of Ayres' brigade with 155th upon Confederate lines. Fierce contest. United States regular band renders cheering, inspiriting music. Enemy routed by 5th Corps. Enemy strong position captured and entrenched by Union line. Death of Captain Clapp in Battle of Alsop's Farm. Heavy loss of regiment. Lieutenant Colonel John Ewing in command of regiment. Casualties. The positions or advances gained or lost by either army as a result of the severe fighting in the wilderness carried with them no significance or military advantage. The pine woods and impenetrable undergrowth so obstructing the view of the contending armies, added to the scarcity of roads, made all movements confusing and unsatisfactory. On the 7th of May, General Grant determined to evacuate the useless positions held by him in the wilderness jungles and directed General Meade to make a night march of the entire army to Spotsylvania Courthouse, a distance of 15 miles, so as to secure the advantage of the open country and also of the many roads radiating from that place. Grant's plan was to secure these roads before the Confederates could overtake him, and to cut from Lee's army communication and supplies and stores from the outside, and also to enable the Union army to continue unmolested on its march towards Richmond. There were but two or three roads from the wilderness to Spotsylvania Courthouse, suitable for traveling or for movements of armies, and the race was soon commenced by both armies for the latter place. The extensive preparations on the afternoon of the 7th by General Grant's army for this change of base naturally led to great discussion on the part of the rank and file as to the destination of the march. Many miles of ammunition, quartermaster, commissary, and headquarter wagon trains, with the proverbial bulky mules and the consequent lurid swearing of their teamsters, not to mention the artillery and caissons with the accompanying noise, made the scenes of this afternoon's preparations for the all-night march most remarkable and not soon to be forgotten. It led naturally in the minds of many in the waiting columns of troops by the wayside and in the entrenchments, who were not to move until the cover of the night concealed their movements, to thoughts concerning the new commander, General Grant, and of the significance of this night's evacuation movement by the left flank. Unbidden memories arose of the many sad retreats of the gallant Army of the Potomac under other commanders, when greatly outnumbering the enemy, as on the present occasion. The Union Army had made retreats from Fredericksburg and from Chancellorsville, near the same territory now being traversed, to the north side of the Rappahannock, for no other reason than that the commanders, Burnside and Hooker, had demonstrated their total inability to handle so large an army, The route of the march of the troops and trains was now in the direction of Chancellorsville, and was most suggestive of a retreat of the Union Army instead of a flank movement, as the marching was termed. The veterans and trained troops under Grant, however, on this occasion, gave way to no such misgivings or doubts in their new commander. The movement of the infantry columns preceded by Sheridan's cavalry, by the left flank, promptly disclosed that the abandonment of the positions of no strategic importance in the Wilderness, and which were no longer worth contesting, was simply a change of base for better positions and partook of none of the qualities of a retreat. The cavalry, leading the advance, guarded the roads on the route of the night march to keep the moving columns of infantry following advised of the position or of the approach of the enemy. The movement required the trains to be set in motion by 3 o'clock in the afternoon of the 7th, so as to clear the road for the troops. It was rightly apprehended that the people of the country would inform General Lee of the movement and that he would surmise its object. In accordance with the project of General Grant, the troops began to move at 8:30 in the evening, General Warren advancing with the 5th Corps by the Brock Road toward Spotsylvania, and General Sedgwick with the 6th Corps by the Plank Road to Chancellorsville. Burnside with the 9th Corps followed Sedgwick. Hancock with the 2nd Corps followed Warren as far as Todd's Tavern. General Sheridan was directed to have a sufficient force on the approaches from the right to keep the corps commanders advised in times of the appearance of the enemy. General Meade and General Grant set out about 11 o'clock p.m. for Todd's Tavern, in advance of the 5th Corps, reaching there about midnight. At 5 o'clock in the morning, General Warren informed General Meade that the head of his column had reached General Merritt's cavalry headquarters at 3:30 a.m., that Merritt's troopers had already moved to clear the road, and that he, General Warren, had massed his troops there as they arrived to give them a rest, for the march on a dark night by a narrow road running through woods had much fatigued them. Also that General Fitzhugh, Lee's cavalry division, had barricaded the road by felling trees across it and had disputed every foot of the ground. Battle of Alsop's Farm or Laurel Hill. In the darkness of the night, General Merritt, commanding the cavalry advance, found it exceedingly difficult to make any progress. At 6 o'clock in the morning, General Warren, upon an intimation from General Merritt that the infantry could push the enemy faster than could his, Merritt's cavalry, ordered an advance of the 5th Corps, and General Robinson's division now leading. In reporting this, General Warren added, "It is difficult to do much with troops in the expeditious manner in these dense woods." The same obstacles continued until about 8:30, when Robinson's division emerged from the woods into the open ground of Alsop's farm, about 2.5 miles from the Spotsylvania courthouse. Robinson advanced his division along the left fork of the Brock Road to the junction of the two roads, Lyle's brigade on the left, Dennison's on the left, and Coulter's brigade on the left rear, where the line was reformed in columns of regiments. Advanced along the road in open ground, with a strong line of skirmishers in front, when within 200 or 300 yards of the woods which the road entered, suddenly a severe musketry and artillery fire was opened upon Robinson's division from an entrenchment just inside of the wood. This staggered them, and in a short time they fell back to the shelter of the woods in the rear, followed by the Confederates. The Maryland Brigade, General Dennison's, took up a position on the edge of the woods and checked the further advance of the enemy, who had turned the left of Lyle's brigade, which had held on close to the enemy's entrenchments under a shelter of a steep crest. General Robinson was severely wounded at the first fire while leading his men. In the meantime, General Griffin placed General Bartlett's brigade in the line of battle in advance, General Ayers and Sweetser's brigades marching on the road. When Bartlett's brigade got halfway across the open ground of Alsop's farm, it also came under fire of the enemy's infantry and artillery. By the exertions of General Griffin, who led his division in person, and of General Bartlett and Ayers, the men reformed, quickly under cover of Ayers' brigade. Griffin again advanced his division, taking the line afterward held for several days. General Crawford came up with his division of the Pennsylvania Reserve Corps, driving the enemy out of the woods in his front. Field's Confederate division of Longstreet's Corps had been coming up all this time and taking part in the fight. They began now to push through the pines on Griffin's right, threatening that flank. Coulter's brigade, which came up, having had several hours' rest, the troops were in good condition, and they advanced in fine style and drove the enemy out of the woods on Griffin's right. The position now held by the 5th Corps was entrenched. It was from 200 to 400 yards distant from that of the enemy. At 12:30 p.m., General Warren reported to General Meade that he had pushed back the enemy, but had not quite gained the junction of the Brock and Catherpin roads. Many of Warren's men, wounded and tired, fell out of the ranks into the woods. Warren also reported that his corps had encountered Fitzhugh Lee's division of cavalry and 2 divisions of Longstreet's corps, from both of which he had taken a number of prisoners. Also that Longstreet's men, thus captured, had stated that they had left their trenches at the Wilderness the night before at 11 o'clock. On the afternoon of the 7th, General Lee directed General R. H. Anderson, now in command of Longstreet's corps, to move to Spotsylvania Courthouse, and at 11 o'clock that night this Confederate corps took up the line of march by the Catherpin Road. It was about 3 miles shorter than that taken by General Warren's corps. Anderson had also the additional advantage of encountering no obstructions or barricades of the enemy. Along this road, Anderson's division of Longstreet's corps was slowly stretching out, endeavoring to unravel the mystery of Warren's movement. A forest fire, so fatal to the Union Army and so fortunate for the enemy in the Wilderness 2 days previous, had by this time spread to the woods through which Longstreet's road led. Once more, fortune favored the Confederates. Once started on the march, Anderson's troops could find no suitable place to bivouac and were compelled to forge ahead so rapidly or fall back beyond the fire zone. The latter course was not to be thought of, and the consequence was that early in the morning of the 8th, they reached the vicinity of Alsop's farm and Spotsylvania in advance of Warren's troops. The foregoing account of the Battle of Laurel Hill, or Alsop's Farm, as it has been termed, relates only generally to the part taken by the 5th Corps under General Warren. Much of it is compiled from the official narrative of General Humphreys, Chief of General Meade's staff. It will be perceived that the movements of General Grant to capture the radiating roads at Spotsylvania Courthouse before General Lee's army could reach there was promptly checkmated and defeated by Lee on discovering the night march of Grant's army by the left flank. This information immediately caused Lee to direct the evacuating of all the Confederate positions in the Wilderness, and was also the cause of the Confederates' forced night march over shorter roads, thereby reaching Spotsylvania Courthouse in advance of Grant's columns. General Meade ordered General Sedgwick with the 6th Corps to move to Spotsylvania Courthouse and there to unite General Warren in immediate and vigorous attack upon the enemy. Spotsylvania Courthouse. The arrangements for the attack of the 5th and 6th Corps were not completed until late in the afternoon, and were then only partial. At 1 o'clock of the same day, by order of General Grant, General Sheridan was directed to move his entire cavalry forces against the enemy's cavalry, and when his supplies were exhausted, to proceed to General Butler near City Point. There was nothing in the site of Spotsylvania Courthouse that gave it special military strength. Its importance was derived from its proximity to the Richmond and Fredericksburg Railroad and the stage and telegraph roads between those towns. Roads also radiated about it in several directions, including a good wagon road to Richmond. No active operations were undertaken against the enemy on the 9th, the army being allowed a much-needed rest. The skirmishers and sharpshooters on both sides, however, were very active, and in the morning, General John Sedgwick was killed while standing close to the entrenchments at the right of his corps, at the point where the forks of the road on Alsop's farm unite. He was highly esteemed, being a modest, brave, courageous, honest-hearted man, much beloved by all of the troops composing the Sixth Corps. The skirmishers of the Fifth and Sixth Corps were pushed forward so as to develop the position and character of the enemy's works and ascertain where they were probably vulnerable. This work was continued by both those corps on the 10th. The part taken by the 155th Regiment in the Battle of Laurel Hill on the 8th calls for more particular mention than is given in the foregoing narrative. On the all-night forced march for Spotsylvania, the regiment, with others, experienced great fatigue and annoyance in the narrow roads, halts being often made every 100 yards or so to ford streams, or on account of obstacles placed in the road by the enemy to impede the progress of the Union troops. Whilst the corps halted at 3 o'clock in the morning, after overtaking General Merritt's cavalry, the men of the 155th availed themselves of the chance for an early breakfast, but were obliged to take their hardtack without their usual accompaniment of warm coffee. Fires were prohibited because of the divisions were expected to fall in at any moment to relieve Merritt's cavalry, which were being pressed on the skirmish line. But it was not until 6 o'clock that the troops were required to come into line for action. As has already been described, Robinson's division of the 5th Corps was first ordered in, and on being repulsed and reformed, General Griffin's division, under his personal supervision, was next formed and ordered to advance. General Griffin gave directions as to the point of the attack. The 155th, as already stated, was serving in General Ayer's brigade of Griffin's division of the 5th Corps, and took part with that brigade under General Ayer's in this morning's attack upon the enemy. The Confederates, on their part, were well prepared for the assault, and from every point of the entrenchments in the woods poured heavy volleys in return to the fire of the Union troops, so that it required a second assault, conducted by General Griffin, to carry the position and to drive the Confederates from the field. On the renewal of the second assault by General Griffin's division, General Ayers ordered his magnificent brigade brass band of the United States Regulars under cover, with orders to render most cheerful and inspiring music as his brigade advanced against the enemy. This fine band, so often heard in camps and reviews, never rendered more timely and more cheering music than it did on this exciting occasion. The routing of the enemy by the 5th Corps and the capturing of their strong positions enabled the Union line to be safely held and entrenched. The spade and other entrenching tools were soon brought to the front and placed in the hands of the troops who had won the positions. The casualties in the 155th Regiment in this engagement, known as Laurel Hill and also as the Battle of Alsop's Farm, were unusually severe, although protected in some respects by the advantageous position chosen by General Ayers. General Warren appeared in this action in the full regulation uniform of a major general, which was presented to him by admiring friends in New York. Receiving it on the march, the general wore it in this battle, but the remainder of the campaign he, like Grant, Meade, and other commanders, appeared in the plain fatigue dress of his rank. Stampede of Pack Mules. A highly exciting incident occurred during this all-night's march. Whilst General Warren's corps was in advance, preceded only by Sheridan's cavalry skirmishers, protecting the roads branching from the main route of the march. As is usual, in all marching of columns, the divisions and brigades have, in addition to their generals and staffs mounted, also a retinue of orderlies and servants on horseback. Immediately following the generals and their retinues on this night's march, were also a number of pack mules, carrying baggage, stretchers, cooking utensils, surgical instruments, and other articles of necessity. The pack mules were led and formed quite a cavalcade in the immediate rear of the headquarters procession, whilst the infantry divisions were marching in the darkness along the main road. They passed along on the right side of the road a mile or more of Hancock's corps, the main body of the troops being sound asleep in their trenches, protected only by pickets. No firing on either side was taking place, and everything was quiet, when suddenly the silence of the marching column was disturbed, and almost a panic occasioned by an alarming noise of clattering hooves, accompanied by shouts and yells as if the enemy's cavalry had attacked the Union infantry column. On! On! The tumult and panic continued to increase, coming apparently at a swift rate back from the head of General Warren's column. It was incomprehensible to the men in the ranks and their officers as no shots were fired to indicate a hostile demonstration. Finally, after an hour's interruption of the march, it was discovered that the cause of the alarm was the breaking loose from their drivers of 50 or 60 pack mules, which fled to the rear on the flanks of the marching column and continued their journey in the darkness along by the portion of the line in which the 155th was marching. How much farther the stampeding mules continued their wild rush is not known, but it was most fortunate that it occurred on the opposite side of the road from where Hancock's veterans were enjoying their much-needed sleep. For had the mules broken into their ranks, arousing them suddenly, there certainly would have been firing and destruction of life under the mistake that it was an attack of the enemy. Casualties, incidents. The death of Captain E.E. Clapp of Company F, who was killed in this Battle of Alsop's Farm, was peculiarly pathetic, as on his person was a 20 days leave of absence which had been issued a few days before the campaign opened, and which he declined to avail himself of in the presence of the enemy. In the Antietam campaign, Captain Clapp was taken ill and nursed in a hospital in the town of Frederick, where he met an estimable young lady in attendance on the sick. This acquaintance ripened into a courtship, an engagement to marry, for which his leave of absence had been procured. He was buried on the battlefield and the grave duly marked, but years afterwards his parents visited Virginia and removed his remains to the family burying ground in Massachusetts. Sergeant Thomas I. Woods, an exemplary soldier of Company B, and Private W.M. Douglas of Company D, fell mortally wounded in this engagement. Among the first to be wounded in this action was Private Samuel W. Hill of Company F, who was struck by a mini-ball on the skull and rendered totally unconscious. He was removed to a field hospital of the Corps adjacent to the battlefield. Private Hill refused a furlough to the hospital in Washington, offered him by reason of his wound, and in less than a week he reported on the firing line at Spotsylvania for duty with his company. The ball which struck Private Hill still remains embedded in his skull, medical men all advising against any attempt to remove it. The late Private James P. O'Neill of Company E, so well known to all the survivors of the regiment since the war as a brilliant newspaper man of Pittsburgh, had a very narrow escape from death on this day's action, the result of a ball's striking his abdomen. The wound bled most profusely, almost dyeing his whole Zouave uniform the crimson color of his body sash. His wound made him hysterical. He left the ranks and ran shouting to General Griffin, who was close by, excitingly pointing out the location of the enemy to the general and his staff. Captain George M. Laughlin, commanding Company E, observing his condition, detailed O'Neill's messmate, Private McKenna, to conduct him to the field hospital nearby. Private Patrick Lowne of Company D also received in this action a severe wound in the knee, necessitating his removal to the field hospital. Private Lyon, from the serious nature of his injuries, was also entitled to a hospital furlough home, but declined it and soon rejoined his company for duty with a musket, although continuing to suffer from his wound. Sergeant Joseph Shahan of Company I, popularly called 40, also fell in this battle, and was buried on the field by his comrades. His remains, with the headboard on which his name was carved, were removed soon after the war to the family lot, Southside Cemetery, Pittsburgh. The weather, for so early in May, was unusually hot and oppressive, and several cases of sunstroke and heat exhaustion occurring to the men of the 155th, causing many to be unable for duty. At the field hospital of the 5th Corps, close to the scene of the fighting, attending from the first wounded to the last of the 155th, was Colonel A.L. Pearson, acting as a volunteer nurse whilst relieved from command. Colonel Pearson, while suffering very much from the apparent injustice of his treatment, remained close to the regiment accompanying it in all its marches and skirmishes, expecting daily to be restored to his command. He rendered most efficient service to the sick and wounded of the regiment, cooperating with the army surgeons in securing for them the best attention. The Christian and Sanitary Commission agents through this campaign appeared, and were prompt and conspicuous in the field, rendering every assistance possible to the soldiers sick or wounded in each battle. There also reappeared on duty at the front and in the field hospitals at this time the faithful volunteer, chaplain-at-large of the 5th Army Corps, Reverend Constantine Agan of Washington, D.C., previously mentioned as having visited the regiment while it was in winter quarters at Warrington Junction and conducting Catholic service. 1st Lieutenant Charles Johnston, commanding Company A in this day's battle, was mortally wounded. He is one of three brothers whose parents were early settlers in Lawrenceville. All the brothers enlisted with Captain Pearson in Company A of the 155th. Lieutenant Edward P. Johnston suffered the loss of his right arm from wounds received in the charge of the 18th of June, 1864, in front of Petersburg, and James B. Johnston, his youngest brother, still in his teens, after a service of 2 years, was honorably discharged by reason of disease contracted in the service and died from the effects thereof soon after the close of the war. 1st Sergeant Thomas N. Woods of Company B was killed on May 8th, the first time that Sergeant Woods was ever known to ask permission to leave his post on march or in battle occurred this day, after the regiment's all-night march to reach Spotsylvania ahead of Lee. When it became evident that a battle was imminent, Sergeant Woods asked Captain H.W. Grubbs for a pass to go to the rear. On his declaring that he was not sick, he was advised by the captain that under the circumstances he could not be excused, and Sergeant Woods resumed his post at the head of the company. Shortly after, during a halt by the roadside, Sergeant Woods wrote in his diary the following, addressed to his friend, Sergeant James A. McMillan, quote, "I am going to fall today. If you find my body, I desire you to bury it and mark my grave so that if my friends desire to take it home, they can find it. Please read the 19th Psalm at my burial." He was killed early in the battle. His body was found by Sergeant McMillan and others of Company B, the diary being found in his pocket. His request for the 19th Psalm to be read at his grave was complied with. And that, my friends, is the end of chapter 12, all in one episode. That's been a while. We will do chapter 13 next week. That is Spotsylvania, North Anna, Bethesda Church, and Cold Harbor. All right, now let's get started into talking about this episode, shall we? It was interesting to hear from the authors about the confidence that they had having in General Grant, not worrying that he would want to fight, unlike the previous generals who led the Army of the Potomac. The fact that they made a special note there means something. Then again, McClellan was, like, bad, and they loved him anyway. So, all right, let's look on. Not a whole lot of notes. This was a lot of troop movements and stuff, but I'll have a lot more if you've never really read about the Battle of Spotsylvania. There's a lot that's going on, so let's get into my minor notes here, and we'll get you on your way. I'll have the pictures up on the website. Let's see. General Sedgwick being killed after saying they couldn't hit an elephant at this distance seems to be like a common refrain among Civil War veterans, isn't it? Like, lightning doesn't strike twice in the same spot. You know? Seems like it's just not a good time to be alive. And then the pack mules scaring everybody. It's not the first stampede story I've read. And I'm also glad it's not going to be the last, because they're always entertaining every single time. And then I guess we'll just talk. I mean, there's a lot of casualties, but I only wanted to talk about a few of them. The first being Captain Clapp, who was killed with papers home in his pocket. That's like saying you're a detective in your last day on the job before retirement in an 80s film. Like, that's just not... Like, dang, man, just go home. I know you want to be with your boys, but just go home. And also, take a moment and think about the woman who was in Frederick and what she went through. She probably received a letter from him being like, you know, I got the time off to come see you. And then she probably reads about a battle in the newspaper, and then he doesn't come home. Man, that's rough. Private Hill being shot in the head with a mini ball stuck inside his brain. Oh boy. And then he went back a week later and stayed with his unit. Goodness gracious. Private O'Neill being a famous newspaper man in Pittsburgh. Having a mini ball hit his stomach. And then he just, like, runs around. That's adrenaline. Adrenaline was doing that for him. Well, how hardcore is Sergeant Woods? Knowing he was going to die and then writing it down? Man, that's crazy. And what he must have felt going into it. So, I thought we would read Psalms 19. You know, why he wanted it at his funeral. So let's read it. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament sheweth his handiwork. Day unto day uttereth speech, and night unto night sheweth knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line is gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them hath he set a tabernacle for the sun, which is a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, and rejoiceth as a strong man to run a race. His going forth is from the end of the heaven, and his circuit unto the ends of it, and there is nothing hid from the heat thereof. The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, yea, than much fine gold, sweeter also than honey and the honeycomb. Moreover, by them is thy servant warned, and in keeping of them there is great reward. Whom can understand his errors? Cleanse thou me from secret faults. Keep back thy servant also from the presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me, then shall I be upright, and I shall be innocent from the great transgression. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, my strength and my Redeemer. Psalms 19, King James Version. That was, I don't know, I just felt like wanting to connect to historical moments in time. You can just imagine yourself as if you are there in his funeral, unfortunately. All right, my friends, with that, I'm going to go ahead and end the episode. By all means, come by and check out my website at rebellionstories.com. I revamped the website. It looks pretty neat. I am going to be doing additional work. I was so mad this week, working so hard on this podcast. And then having to redo it. Just happens, I guess. But happy Mother's Day to all the moms that are out there. And make sure if you get the chance that you are wishing your mommy a happy Mommy's Day. I expect all of you will be making bed and breakfast. So I know for us, we're going to watch some of her favorite movies and then make her breakfast. But all right, my friends. Take care of your mommies this weekend. I will see you next week. Visit my website, rebellionstories.com. There you can go all the way down to the bottom, go to contact me, and then you can email me, whatever you like. I'm working on a couple of other ways, but this will be, I don't know. Anyway, I'm out of here. Bye-bye. They will find him and know him amongst the good and true. When a robe of white is given for that faded coat of blue, no more the bugles.
called the weary one. Rest, noble spirit, in thy grave alone. They will find you and know you amongst the good and true. When a robe of white is given for that faded coat of blue, he cried, give me water and just one little crumb, and my mother, she will bless you through all the years to come. Go tell my sweet sister, so gentle, good and true, that I'll meet her up in heaven or in my faded coat of blue. No more the bugle calls the weary one. Rest, noble spirit, in thy grave alone. They will find you and know you amongst the good and true. When a robe of white is given for that faded coat of blue.